Come on in. Got a couple open seats up front, got a couple open seats in the middle, and I got one in the back row. So there you go. There you go. All right. Well, welcome. This is our last session in this study on cultural cartography. Just a few announcements. Next Thursday at exactly the same time, in exactly the same place, we're hosting Clinton Sato, who's a missionary that we support in Armstrong through Rural Life Mission. Really encourage you to come out and hear about the mission work that Clinton is doing and to get to know him. On April 22nd, which is a Saturday, the Baptist women are meeting here at Walsh, and our own Emily Dargy is the guest speaker. And so for you women who want to take that in, I encourage you to take, there's a poster on the hall bulletin board. And when is the Walsh study starting, Susan? Is that May? May 2nd, that's a morning, that's a Tuesday morning study here at the church for women that's going to be going on. As far as our own Bible study, so Clinton's here next week, and I think we'll take a week off after that. Keep your ear to the ground. I would like to run one more study before I leave on vacation. I've got some vacation in June and July, but I think we could maybe get in a short 5 or 6 week study. We maybe will take advantage of our new Right Now Media and do a video study. I am thinking, and I'd be interested to hear input on this for the fall when we come back together, because we'll do one more short study before summer break, but we usually take a break over the summer. The two options that are kind of most on my mind for something similar to this, something fairly in-depth with PowerPoint presentation with lots of study on my part, one is kind of spinning out of this a study on how come I can't think of what it was, came out of the second week of study, third week of study, natural law. Truman said one thing that the church ought to do in this particular period of time is get a better grip on natural law biblically, coming out of that passage in Romans where it says God has inscribed, you know, his law upon the heart. All people know there's a certain aspect of law that all people know regardless, and that's a fairly in-depth subject, and I've picked up a few books on that. That's one subject I'd be interested in teaching on. The other, I've got a good book at home, and I've been wanting to do a study for a while on the 9 marks of a healthy church. That comes out of Mark Deaver. And he wrote the book, 9 Marks of a Healthy Church, and would be probably a 9-week study on the 9 marks of a healthy church. So take those in, think about those, or if there's another subject that you're maybe interested in and you say, I'd like to have an in-depth study on that, let me know, and then I'll spend the summer doing my reading and getting ready so that we can do something like this again. All right, let's open with a word of prayer, and then we'll get into this subject. Heavenly Father, Lord, I am grateful for every person that has been part of this study, Lord, here in person, online. Father, those who have been here for every single one, those who have come for some and been online for others, Lord, those who are following later on and watching the video of these, Lord, I pray that they might be a helpful, thought-provoking, useful tool for many years to come. And Lord, I pray most of all that the outcome of this would be an increase in godliness for your church, Lord, an increase in our desire to reach people with the gospel, and an increase in our effectiveness in doing that. And Father, I just pray for simplicity and straightforwardness as I teach this final subject tonight, and we just ask your blessing now in Jesus' name. Amen. kind of amazing that there was at least one study that we came this close to canceling because there was forecast ice storm, and here we are just about sweating in this room here for the last study, and maybe appropriate as we're doing ethics of the earth, environmentalism, and the care of creation. So let me just begin with this picture. Can a Christian be an environmentalist, or should a Christian be an environmentalist, or is environmentalism so far removed from Christianity that never the twain shall meet? That's part of the question we want to ask today. But one thing, I just wanted to start off showing you some images of this world, because we spend too much time inside. We spend too much time inside. We need to go outside more often. Here's another one. These images, by the way, are images that I captured on my pedal to the sea trip. These were all pictures I took from the saddle of my bicycle as I rode along. I marvel at creation. I think creation is phenomenal. This is the point that I stopped 2 years ago at Dalhousie, New Brunswick. This is the Dalhousie Lighthouse. What's really interesting about Dalhousie in New Brunswick, not in Nova Scotia, that's a college in Nova Scotia, but in New Brunswick, this is the only pretty place in the whole little village. Seriously. This village was the site of one of the largest paper plants in the world, and their entire waterfront is nothing but brownlands. And this particular lighthouse was right here, and I put the bike there and I took a picture. So let me tell you two stories, just kind of funny stories to break the ice. Last year, the Baptist Assembly held their assembly in a church in Northeast Scarborough. And I don't think it was absolutely necessary, but Michelle was on call that weekend. I could have arranged another vehicle, but it was a nice weekend in June. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to ride my bicycle to Northeast Scarborough. Well, I actually said, I'm going to ride my bicycle from Simcoe. And I said, when I get to Aldershot, I can get on the GO train. The GO train will take me down to Union Station, and then I can either ride up to Scarborough, or I can catch a bus or a streetcar, because you can take your bicycle on those things. But I got riding. It was a beautiful day, and I got to Aldershot, and I thought, I'm still feeling good. And if you know that route, you know that the train line runs right alongside the road that I would be riding along. So I'm riding along roads and trails. I thought, I'll just keep riding along, and when I get tired, I can stop and get on the GO train. And as I got riding along, I started checking my mileage. And I thought, you know, the thing I've never yet done in my life, I've ridden many of what we sometimes call centuries, a 100-kilometer ride. When I'm on these trips, I ride usually 100 kilometers a day for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. So riding 100 kilometers has become old hat. But I thought to myself, I looked at the mileage and I thought, I've never rode an imperial century. Anybody know what an imperial century is? Anybody want to guess what an imperial century is? The imperial century. There it is. 100-mile ride. And I thought, I've never had an imperial century. I'm going to ride an imperial century today. And I did. It took me, I left Simcoe early, 5:30, 6 o'clock, first light to start riding. I rolled into the church parking lot in Northeast Scarborough at 10 p.m., wow. 185 kilometers in, with my knees feeling like they were made out of glass. I was 5 kilometers from the hotel room I had booked, and I thought, I do not want to ride 5 more kilometers. It's 10 o'clock at night. There were some trees behind the church. I slung up my hammock. I slept in the trees behind the church in Northeast Scarborough, just on the very edge of Markham. And I tell you this story because this is why this is a funny story, and this is why it's related to environmentalism. There are in the CBOQ a fairly broad spectrum, and there are some real tree-hugging sort of hippy-dippy, Fruit Loopy kind of people in the CBOQ who like to drive their electric cars and then make a big deal about that. And I had a lot of fun coming out of the trees with my big beard, you know, pulling a few like this. People are like, were you sleeping in those trees? And you're like, yeah, I just put my hammock in there. And then coming up to my uber liberal friends and saying to them, you guys drove those electric cars? And yeah, I said, those things aren't really that good for the environment. And they set in right away, well, it's a lot better than what you rode. I said, I rode my bicycle. And they said, from Simcoe? And I said, yeah, 185 kilometers from Simcoe. I'm greener than anybody. You know, but yeah, I tell you that story just in breaking the ice and getting us ready for this conversation. Here's one other conversation. My middle son, Sam, has got the distinction of being born on April 22nd, which is every year Earth Day. So we at least turn off the lights long enough to light a candle on his cake so he can blow it out. Right? But here's an interesting thing. You know, I was in Joy Cafe the other day, standing behind a couple girls, somewhere around the age of these fellas here. And they were speaking with, not with Joy, but whoever was running the counter. They were very interested because Joy plants trees for so every day that she's open. They plant trees and stuff like that. These girls were so invested. They were just so pleased and impressed that the trees were being planted, that all this was being done. And as I sat there, and this I want to kind of challenge you on this a little bit. When the Apostle Paul says, I am all things to all people, we know that he is not saying that he is willing to enter into a sinful sort of lifestyle to reach people who are in a sinful lifestyle. But he is saying, listen, to the Jew, I become as a Jew. To the Gentile, I become as a Gentile. On these areas of, we would use the big word, adiaphora, or debatable matters, he says the gospel takes precedence. The gospel takes preeminence. And if I need to eat a ham sandwich because that's what's being served at dinner at this particular person's house, then let's do that so that the gospel can go forth. If I need to put on whatever attire the Jewish people put on in order to be welcomed at this table for the sake of the gospel, let me do this. And I just want to say right at the beginning that I think we need to take that passage into account as we think about these things, because an awful lot of stuff when we talk about environmentalism is adiaphora, or is matters that are debatable but are not of a moral significance, and for the sake of the gospel. And here's one of the things that we've done here at the church. You will notice we have paper plates and not styrofoam cups, although once in a while styrofoam cups show up. That is an intentional act on my part and on the part of some other people that are providing that, because paper is more sustainable than styrofoam, and it sends a message to young people who are coming into the church who maybe are very big on this. If they come in and the first thing they're handed is a styrofoam cup, they go, this church doesn't care about the environment, right? And that is one of those all things to all people. For a small cost, we have the ability to be more effective for the gospel than potentially putting up a roadblock for the gospel. So anyways, all this in way of introduction. Here's how I want to really get started. And this ties into everything we've talked about in this entire study. The question of the identity of the Christian. What is the framework or the grid through which I view the world? And there are two potential frameworks or two potential grids through which we can view the world. One is we can view the world through our political identity. Now, I'm not going to ask this question out loud. I'm going to ask you out loud. I'm not going to ask for a response. But I presume that most people in this room vote. Right? But I'm not going to ask you who you vote for. But the question is, if you vote, you have something of a political identity. You have something that you believe. And one of the ways, probably the predominant way, through which most people, most of your neighbors, view the world is they view the world through their political identity. That's even more so to the south of the border, but it's becoming more and more so here. There's been more animus, more anger, more wrathfulness that is based on political stuff in Canada over the last half decade than I ever remember in my life. Right? So we can look at the world through our political identity. Or the other way that we look at the world as Christians is we look at the world through a theological identity. And both of those things probably come to bear. I know both of those things come to bear in my life. I have political opinions about certain things. I have theological opinions about certain things. But the question is, are my politics required to match my theological identity? Or is my theology required to match my political identity? That's a heavy question. And here I'm going to say something that is perhaps controversial, but I'm going to say it anyways. If the political party that you vote for always represents everything that you think is right, very likely you have a political identity that should be pivoted to a theological identity. There are no political parties that are running candidates in Canada who I agree with entirely theologically. That doesn't mean I don't vote for one of them, but if you have a theological identity, you will discover that there is no political party in Canada that can actually match the things that the Bible calls you to do. I want to challenge you a little bit on that. So here are three different approaches to the environment. Okay? There is the anthropocentric approach. Okay, this is, you guys love this because you get all these big words. Okay, anthropology, anthropomorphism. That word means man. Pocentric, that's centric. Okay, the man-centered approach. That's one. There is the biocentric approach. That's the earth or the environment-centered approach. And then there is the, I'm going to argue, a theocentric approach. And this is what these three look like. The anthropocentric, the man-centered approach, begins this way. God created the earth for humans. Is that right? Okay, God created this earth, and he made it for humans. We have been given dominion and are thus master of the earth, right? Thinking this through your theological grid work, this is trickling down. You should be hearing echoes of some Genesis stuff in here. Okay, the value of the minerals, the soil, the air, the water, the creatures is based on their utilitarian value to humans, right? If God created the earth for humans, we've been given dominion, we're the masters, then the value of what is here is directly corresponding to what value it has for me. What value is gold? What value is oil? What value is a cow? What value is clean water? That's all dependent on me. It's anthropocentric, it's man-centered. Economic factors very often drive the anthropocentric approaches to the environment. So how can I monetize this? How can I maximize my financial gain from this? How can we harness the environment in order to maximize our materialistic gains as far as mining, farming, all those sorts of things? And then finally, the earth exists to serve the needs of the human race. Really, this and this are the same thing. This is the anthropocentric approach. Okay? And there are definitely some biblical things in here, and we're going to talk about those as we go through the ethics. But this is very particularly aligned with right-sided as in right-wing political parties, right? We recognize that. If you vote conservative, if you vote Republican, these are things that tend, some of this, there's various different approaches. So some of these are more extreme and some of them are less extreme. But we see the earth is created for humans. These things have a utilitarian value to us. Economic factors drive our approaches to the environment. So here's the biocentric approach, and this typifies the left wing of the political spectrum. It begins this way. God made the earth as an end in itself. The earth has no teleological purpose. It has no particular purpose. This particular approach in the West here generally is filtered through Darwinian evolution. We're here by accident. This is a great big bang that has brought all this about, and all of these systems are naturally occurring. human beings have no intrinsic worth higher than any other species or systems on Earth. And again, there's many different approaches inside of this category. Some of them are better and some of them are worse. Probably the worst representations say that human beings are parasitic and probably we need to get rid of a whole lot of them. But there's many, many groups there that have a high view of the human, but not a higher view of the human than they do of the cow or the otter or the blue whale. All beings on the earth have an equal intrinsic worth, and none can claim a higher worth than the other. Two different religious systems that tend to fit into some sort of biocentric approach, pantheistic approaches to God, such as Hinduism or indigenous religions, the First Nations people, any group that has a tendency to see God as mediated through different creatures. If you talk to First Nations people, the wolf spirit, the eagle spirit, the otter spirit, the fish spirit, these things are all, the earth is alive and God is incumbent in the earth. Hinduism, many forms of Hinduism, cows are sacred animals. Right, that you don't eat a cow because part of the whole reincarnation system, but it's part of the religious system. The other form of a religious system that is very biocentric and that we're probably more familiar with here, New Age systems, Gaia, that's worship of Mother Earth, Wiccan, witchcraft, neo-pagan religions, the Druids, all these things are very in vogue. Some of the fastest growing religious groups in the West today are New Age, Gaia, Wiccan, neo-pagan, and they all see, if there is a God, if they believe in God or deity, they see the deity as mediated through the earth, and so we worship the earth. And this is the direction I want to push you in. I would say to you, if the two political parties, one of them goes with an anthropocentric view and the left goes with a biocentric view, that the Christian does not have a political identity but a theological identity, which means there's certain elements of both that we think are valuable and there's certain elements of both that we want to argue against and say are wrong. And so this is what's involved in a theocentric approach to the environment. God created the earth, its system, and its creatures for himself. That's what's different from the anthropocentric, that God made this world and everything in it for himself. And I would argue that when you get to Colossians 1, I don't have it right in front of me, or John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Through him, everything was made. Without him, nothing was made that was made. But Colossians 1, which is the one that's eluding my mind, somebody can look that up and maybe I'll read it in a moment. But I would argue God created this earth, its systems, and its creatures for himself, including you. God is dynamically involved in the ongoing care of creation. Humans have a role as stewards of the earth. While humans may use the earth, they must acknowledge moral limits upon the use of its creatures and its systems, because these things do not exist for you. These things exist for God, and God puts limits on how we use what he has given to us. So here's my argument for a theocentric approach. And I meant to do this at the beginning. Two books, one that was somewhat interesting. This is Kingdom Ethics by Gushy and Stassen, has a chapter. But the one that I would really recommend to you is Sandra Richter, who wrote this little tiny book called Stewards of Eden. And one of the things I really like about her book, and this book was well reviewed by Gospel Coalition, which is a group that I hold in high regard, is unlike many books that get caught up in all sorts of statistics and numbers. And the problem with statistics and numbers is the biocentric group has their set of scientists with their set of numbers, and the anthropocentric group has their set of scientists and their set of numbers, and there's just constant argument and animosity, and one group is thinking the world is 10 billion years old, and one group is thinking the world is 6,000 years old, and Sandra Richter just stays out of that whole mess. She basically gives, a lot of what you're going to see here is stuff that she gives, a theocentric argument for a biblical ethic of environmentalism. And so I recommend her to you. You can have a look at that book at the end of the study if you like. So God creates the world in 7 days. Genesis 1 gives us this story. In the first 3 days, God creates the habitats. Day 1, he creates the day and the night. Day 2, he creates the sea and the sky. Day 3, he creates the dry land. That's the first 3 days of creation, the habitats. And in day 4 to 6, God creates the inhabitants that live in the habitats he has made. He creates what he calls the rulers, the sun and the moon to rule the day and the night. They inhabit the habitat, right? God created day and night, created the sun and the moon, created the sea and the sky, and he creates the fish and the birds as the inhabitants that live in those things. And then finally he created the dry land, and day 6 gets the longest treatment of all because he creates animals and he creates man in his own image as the rulers. And in each of these, the rulers of the day, the sun, the night, the moon, the sky, the birds, the sea, the fish, the earth, the beasts, but particularly man as the steward and the representative who is made ruler over all. And then on day seven, the Sabbath, which is the rest of God, I want you to note, at the end of each of the days, day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and particularly day 6, God declares creation good, and after day 6, very good. God delights in what he has made. He has made it for himself. It is a display of his glory. And in the case of day 6, it is an expression of himself. And then finally, God rests from creation. And this Sabbath becomes an integral part of the entire pattern of creation. And it echoes down through the pages of Scripture over and over and over again in the life of Israel, in the life of the church, in the final state. This idea of Sabbath keeps on echoing. So let me just pull out a few things here that I think are key. A couple Bible passages. Man is the crown of God's creation. So how is he to conduct himself? Here's the two passages that I think are very relevant. God says, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So here we have all but the sun and the moon are really placed under the dominion, under the governance, under the stewardship, under the dominion of man. That man is God's representative. God says, let us make man in our image. And so when God makes man, and this is the argument that I would make for what does it mean to be made in the image of God, not that I look like God, but that I have the capacity to reflect something of God. I have a very smart dog in my house. She makes me look good. She is fast. She's half husky, half border collie. You know, the first time I ever threw a frisbee, she caught that frisbee in her mouth. And every other time I've ever thrown a frisbee, and I've thrown a frisbee 1,000 times, she catches it every time. If I could throw it half a mile, she would run half a mile and catch it in her mouth. And everybody looks and goes, you're the greatest dog trainer we've ever saw. And she does it by instinct. She just does it by instinct. But you know, that dog, border collie, one of the smartest dogs you can get, doesn't matter how many border collies, you can put a whole herd of border collies together, they will never come up with a better method for herding sheep than what they have by instinct. And yet you take a human being, you put a bunch of human beings together in a room with a whole bunch of sheep and say, you got to come up with a way of herding these sheep. And after a little while, those human beings are going to come out, and they're going to come out with an idea, and they're going to keep improving on the idea. They're going to keep developing the idea. They're not only going to figure out how to herd the sheep, they're going to figure out how to shear the sheep, how to cart the wool, how to spin the wool, how to make the wool into super fine suit jackets that have got nice pinstripes on them with a silk lining, and they're going to figure out how to roast the lamb, and they're going to figure out everything. The sheepdog never figures it out. Never figures it out. That's because man is made in the image of God. God is a creator. Man is a creator. God reasons. Man reasons. God is ordered. Man orders. God is a ruler. Man rules. God has the capacity to love in deep and profound ways. Man has the capacity to love in ways that no animal ever will. God has made us in his image and given us dominion. But he also, in Genesis 2, tells us something about what that dominion looks like. Genesis chapter 2, verse 15, the Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to work it and keep it. And I would argue that in the theocentric view of environmentalism, that this here is tempered by this. Here we have dominion, we are given rule, we are given responsibility. Right? You can't have authority without responsibility. My boys, look over. They hear about this all the time. You have responsibility. You're responsible for this. And as you grow in your responsibility, you will gain more authority. Right? So God has given us authority. He's also given us responsibility. There we go. And this is a great quote from Sandra Richter. She says this: here there would always be enough. Progress would not necessitate pollution. Expansion would not require extinction. The privilege of the strong would not demand the deprivation of the weak. And humanity would succeed in this calling because of the guiding wisdom of their God. This is how God created the world for himself, for his glory, put man on it as the ruler to keep it. And then comes the fall. And the result of the fall is not the destruction of creation or the destruction of God's intention for creation, but rather the corruption of creation and the distortion of God's purpose. Everything about creation becomes corrupted with the fall. The relationship between man and woman, corrupted. The life of man and woman, corrupted. The creation itself, corrupted and put into bondage. And God's purpose is distorted, but not lost. And I will argue that God's redemptive action does not exclude the whole of creation. It entails it. That in redeeming mankind, God is also redeeming the whole of his creation, that he is not going to throw out that which he has made and called good, but is rather going to redeem it. So, here's the first. I've got about four things we're going to deal with. This is the longest. And this is, we're going to pull an awful lot out of the book of Deuteronomy today. Because when God gives Israel the land, so after 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, this group of slaves that have been out there in the wilderness, finally under Joshua, not Moses, are about to enter the land. And the last thing God gives to Moses to do is to give them Deuteronomy, which is literally second law. And they're over and over and over again in the book of Deuteronomy, we hear things like this. Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 33. It's not up here, but you could write this down, look it up later. Deuteronomy 5, 33, Deuteronomy 30, 18, Deuteronomy 32, 47, all have some variation of this. Here's Deuteronomy 5, 33. You shall walk in all the way that the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live and that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land that you shall possess. And the argument here is that God does not surrender ownership of the land to Israel, but instead gives the land to Israel as tenants of the land, that he is the suzerain, he is the Lord, they're the vassal, they're the servants, that he is a very gracious and good landlord. But over and over again, he tells them, this is what is entailed in keeping this land. So here's this passage. And if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you. If you obey the voice of the Lord your God, blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the field. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, the increase of your herds, and the young of your flock. Blessed shall be your basket and kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. This is the beginning of a set of blessings that God offers to Israel. Israel's identity as a lessee is most evident in the laws of tithes, of first fruits, and the offering of the firstborn that populate the Mosaic covenant. Here we find that the people of Israel, much like renters, were expected to pay a percentage of their income to Yahweh via the tabernacle. And the purpose of these tithes and first fruits and the offering of the firstborn, there were a couple. One was in order for the people to remember that they had a God and they were not simply their own masters, that this was not an anthropocentric world, this was a theocentric world. One was to alleviate the need of the poor, and one was to cover the cost of supporting the priests and the Levites. The act of tithing, and particularly the act of first fruits and the offering of the firstborn. So the law of Israel was when you go out to harvest, the first heads of grain that you get, the first barley harvest, the first basket that comes in, this belongs to the Lord. And you bring this to the priest at the temple and you offer the offering of first fruits. The feast of first fruits is a feast of bringing in the harvest, not to eat for ourselves, but to give to the Lord. The firstborn, every firstborn animal, whether it was man or beast, was to be offered to the Lord. And the Lord replaced the offering of the firstborn son with who? Well, everybody goes to Jesus, but in the Old Testament to the Levites, right? The Levites become that, God puts the Levites in and they are committed, the entire tribe of Levi is given to God. But every firstborn animal, if it's a clean animal, it's a sacrifice. If it's an unclean animal, you have to break its neck. It is forfeit, or you pay the redemption price to keep that animal. And this act is an act of tremendous sacrifice, which is an act of worship to God, but it's also a tremendous act of faith, because the giving of a first fruit or the giving of the firstborn is the faith that there is going to be a second, that God is going to give more, that this is not all there is. And that leads to this passage here. For 6 years, you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but in the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave, the beasts of the field may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and your olive oil. So the three main components of ancient Israelite economy is your grain harvest, your vineyard, your grape harvest, and your olive orchard for olive oil. This is where the income comes from. This is what you consume and eat. And God says to them, you are to, every seventh year, you're to simply pass over that harvest. And I want you to notice, he says, the poor of your people may eat it. Right? It's a provision for the poor, and what they leave behind, the beasts of the field may eat. But think about that for a minute. Why is God calling them to lay the land fallow? Here is Richter again. The Sabbath mandate in Israel's agricultural system limited short-term yield, but helped ensure long-term productivity. We know this. Science has taught us this, but Israel had this in their law before science taught it to us, that fallowing the land increases its productivity. Fallowing the land ensures that the land will not wear out. Prince Edward Island with its red soil, Michelle and I were out there this past summer for a long bicycle ride. I had fun. She was okay. That red soil is really poor soil. And the farmers who first settled Prince Edward Island said that within a couple of harvests, The harvest just kept declining and declining and declining and declining because the soil was not good soil, and they had to learn how to heal the soil. Our farms to this day, we have to deal with soil in certain ways. The really interesting thing about being sheep farmers, which is what the Israelites were, is it makes a lot of sense. If you grow wheat in a field one year, the next year you leave that for pasture, and the sheep go in there and eat whatever comes up all by itself, along with all the grass, and they leave all their manure around, and their hooves poke holes in the ground, and the next year you farm it again. It works really well. So the Sabbath mandate in Israel's agricultural system limited short-term yield. They could have got more from the land. They could have taken more from the grapevines. They could have taken more out of the trees. They could have harvested right to the very edges of their fields, but God said, don't do that. They could have harvested 7 years in a row, but God said, don't do that. It limited short-term yield, but helped ensure long-term productivity. And from this, Richter draws this conclusion that it is not acceptable for any populace to take from the land everything that it can give, or the populace to take everything that it can. Rather, as the law of Israel teaches us, God's people are commanded to operate with the long-term well-being of the land as their ultimate goal. So, as we leave tenants of the land, I want to ask this question. Knowing the Lord's standard for the use of the soil, should I as a Christian have no concern for how my bread was produced? Because I think we're far enough removed, we don't go outside very often, we're an indoor people, that we do not ask sometimes the question, where do all the grains come from that I eat? But we should. Because God, I think, has some concern for this. And this, I think, speaks to us a little bit about mass monoculture farming and whether or not that's an ethical thing that we should support as Christians. Genetic engineering of crops in order to get more and more out of the crops. I think these are things. I'm leaving you with more questions than answers, just so you know. I'm not giving you answers on these things. I'm just provoking it a little bit. Okay, the use of chemical pesticides, how much should we do that? Is there a limit? What are the downsides? Talk to a beekeeper. Okay, here's another aspect of biblical ethics. This is all creatures, great and small, and in the field, this is what God has to say about your domestic animals. But the seventh day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your sons or your daughters or your male servant or your female servant or your ox or your donkey or any of your livestock or the sojourner who is within your gate, that your male servant, your female servant may rest as well as you. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. The Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched hand. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. I want you to notice the Sabbath extended not only to the master, but to the servant. Not only to the father, but to the mother and to the children. And not only to the people, but also God extends the Sabbath to all your livestock. I love this quote. Israel is a nation of slaves. These are people who have never known freedom. Their parents and grandparents before them had lived out their entire lives subject to their masters, laboring endlessly with no self-determination, systematically dehumanized until old age and abuse deposited their broken bodies in the ground. But in the radically different relationship offered to Israel at Sinai, a new kind of master commands his people to rest. Every 7 days, stop for 24 hours, just stop. And while you are stopping, remember who you are. Here's another passage. You shall not muzzle an ox when it is treading out its grain. The Israelites didn't eat an awful lot of beef. Beef was a rare thing because a cow was enormous. right? And a cow is very costly, and a cow has other uses. A cow can be used for milk, if it's a female cow, and a male cow can be allowed to become an ox, and the ox was their big piece of machinery, their powerful piece of machinery. Also, in the age before refrigeration, if you're going to kill a cow, hey, you're going to have to eat a lot. And so the peace offering was actually, the peace offering is one of the offerings that Israel had that didn't have provision for small things, because it was intended, it was the one offering that the offerer got back, and he had to eat it within 3 days. How are you going to eat a bull in 3 days? You're going to invite the entire community and say, this is my gratitude to God for what he has done. I give this peace offering. I bring this enormous animal. I sacrifice it, and I invite everybody to eat it because it has to be gone in 3 days. So you've got this monster-sized animal, and it's treading out your grain. And the temptation, if you're a subsistence farmer and a dry farmer, which means you don't have irrigation, you don't have chemical fertilizers, you don't have any of those things, you have to count on what's going to grow up from the ground, is put a muzzle on that thing. Why? When God commands the Israelites not to muzzle his 800-pound working bovine, he's talking to a man who is hungry. And the 5 to 7 pounds of grain that the ox could consume over a single day of threshing makes a difference, and they thresh for more than one day. I mean, this here's your tractor keeps eating up 7 pounds of your food every day, yet God commands his farmer to allow the beasts who serve them the opportunity to enjoy their life and their work. Can an animal enjoy life and work? To benefit from the fruit of their labors. Here we're just messing around a little bit with your mind, right? Is it possible for an animal to know the difference between enjoyment and misery? Well, I mean, if you've got a dog, you probably go, yeah, I think my dog knows the difference. Every time I leave, it's, oh, every time I'm back, oh, you know. I know my uncle was a beef farmer. A small-scale beef farmer, and every single cow in that barn had a name. Every cow had a name, you know, and every cow in that barn would come up to him, and he would get his hand in there, scratch his head, scratch his back. And I think an animal has the ability to know enjoyment and to know suffering. And God, I think, has a desire that these beasts who are serving the Israelites should enjoy their life and should enjoy their work and should benefit from the fruit of their own labors. Here's my final thoughts on this here. Knowing the Lord's standard for the care of farm animals, should I as a Christian be concerned with the quality of life given to the animals that will one day feed me? Because we live inside, we don't pay attention, we buy our meat at the grocery store, we never think, I wonder what happened to this meat before I got it, but is that right? Is God not concerned about the quality of life that the animal has? Does a pig or a chicken or a cow have any intrinsic worth beyond its utility as meat for my plate? Does that animal have some sort of intrinsic worth in the eyes of God that says this animal should, during its life, know something of enjoyment? I know, chickens, how much enjoyment, right? They got a little tiny brain, right? But, you know, this is the thing. When you just see them, when pigs are kept standing upright for 120 days in a farrowing that they cannot lay down, and then caused to lie down, have their litter, and then made to stand up again until they wear out and die, I don't think I have to be a left-wing hippy-dippy to say I got an issue. I think this isn't right. Which leads me to this, and again, I'm giving you more questions than answers today. Does this lead me to potentially alter where I buy my meat? Even if the increased cost of buying meat from the butcher where I go, I know the farmer, I'm not saying do this, I'm just saying this is a question. Even if that means I eat less meat than my neighbor. When my son Micah comes home, he comes home tomorrow night at midnight, you know the first thing he's asked? He says, I want to go through a drive-thru and get a burger. Do you know why he wants to have a burger? Because for 9 months, he says, I haven't had meat for 9 months. He says, I've eaten dal bhat for 9 months. I've eaten noodles and rice for 9 months. And that's not because he just passed on the meat. It's because there are places in the world where people almost never, ever, ever eat meat. And somehow we have this idea in our mind that if we didn't get meat at every meal, maybe even at breakfast, we didn't actually have a meal. And I'm just asking the question. I'm intentionally making you a little bit uncomfortable, I know. So let's talk for a moment about the forest. All creatures great and small, the forest. Job 39, verse 1 to 3. God challenging Job, do you know where the mountain goats give birth? Because God says, I do. Do you observe the calving of the does? Because I do. Can you number the months they fulfill? Do you know the time when they give birth? God does. When they crouch and bring forth their offspring and are delivered from their young? Here's another commandment having to do with the wild beasts, the wild creatures. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with young ones or eggs, and the mother is sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long in the land. You're a tenant. If you don't follow these rules, God says, I will evict you. And he does. He eventually evicts Israel out of the land because they don't follow his commands. But what is this? This is what the theologians call a pars pro toto. You know, these are the little things I give you so you can learn funny words. Which is a part of something that represents the whole. What does that mean? That God is talking particularly about birds and eggs, but this same principle, that this part represents the whole of how he intends us to deal with nature. That when we go out into nature and encounter wild animals that are food type animals, that we are not killing. I think probably the modern day representation of this is that we have hunting seasons, so we are not hunting the deer during breeding season, so that you're killing the deer and the offspring at the same time, right? That's a pars pro toto, that God is saying, listen, you can take the eggs, leave the mother, sustainability, allow this to continue so that you can continue to go on. Let me show you a picture about dealing with wild animals. What are we looking at?
Slaughter of the buffalo on the plains.
Okay. How many people? Well, I don't want to ask that question. Okay. Does anybody think this was a good idea? Anybody want to stand up and say, this was a good idea? Look, here's a train. A whole bunch of guys on the roof of the train. The train's going along. It's big game hunting. We're just dropping them. Bump, 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 bump. You know, how many did they kill? That's a painting. So let's have a picture. That many. I mean, that's just one picture. But I mean, is this not an ethical issue that is addressed in Scripture? When you are just the wholesale slaughter, and one of the reasons for the wholesale slaughter of the buffalo is because we want to press west and build farms, and these buffalo are herding all over the stuff we want to build farms on. Let's get rid of them. You go, well, do we do that now? We do. We continue to build our houses on greenbelt lands, and you go, oh, he's getting a little hippy-dippy. I did wear my sandals tonight, right? I didn't mean to wear sandals. Somebody took my socks, but, you know, when this is the right whale, and the right whale is reduced very dramatically, we keep running into them with our giant cargo ships. And they say there's ways that we can get around that. We got to go slower and put a few more things on. But the prices go up on commodities coming from China. So we keep running over right whales. Southern Ontario has lost 70% of our wetlands, 80% of our forests, and 98% of our greenlands. That's a count from when it was first settled. But that's still, you know, questions when we're talking about the wild beasts. Do we have an ethical responsibility to consider these things? More questions than answers. Resources, renewable and otherwise. This is the last thing before the conclusion of our study. So I think we're tracking along okay here. resources, renewable and otherwise. So God says this in Deuteronomy chapter 20 to the Israelites. He says, when you besiege a city for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. You may eat from them, but you shall not cut them down. Are the trees in the field human that they should be besieged by you? Only the trees that you know are not fruit trees for food you may destroy and cut down, that you may build siege works against the city that makes war with you until it falls. It's very interesting. I mean, this is God literally showing concern for trees. This is God who made this creation for himself. The right whale is God's right whale. The buffalo are God's buffalo. The trees are God's trees. And he says, you can eat from those trees. You cannot cut them down. It is not in your interest to destroy the resources that you're going to need in the future. And if you go in there and simply cut everything down and build siege works out of it, and you get that city, then once you've got the city, you've destroyed all your resources. When you reap the harvest of your land, this is Leviticus 19, 9 and 10, you shall not reap your field right up to its edges, neither shall you gather the gleaning after your harvest, and you shall not strip your vineyards bare, neither shall you gather fallen grapes off your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord. What happens if we take this principle and we apply that instead to the resources that the Israelites didn't know about yet, that was right underneath their feet? The oil that's down there, the nickel cadmium that you need to make electric car batteries, the coal and the iron ore and the gold and the silver. Are we conducting ourselves in a moral way where we say we will consume all that is there? We will have no limits on how much we consume. We have no concern for the poor or the sojourner or a later generation. At the end of the day, we know this about many of these resources, is they're not renewable resources. We have only been tapping these things out of the earth for about 100 years, and I don't know how long they last for. If you ask the biocentric people, they'll give you one number. If you ask the anthropocentric people, they'll give you another number. The theocentric people will say, it just takes a little bit of pause, more questions than answers. But the reality is, there is a limit to how much is in there. And someday, it will run out. And then what? It's not that they never mined out the resources. I like this. Have you ever seen this passage in Job? This is not... Everybody who reads Job reads the first two or three chapters and then jumps to the last five chapters and skips all the middle. This is in the middle where Job is talking about where can wisdom be found? And it's very descriptive. He says this, surely there is a mine for silver and a place for gold that they refine. Iron is taken out of the earth and copper smelted from the ore. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out to the farthest limits, the ore in gloom and deep darkness. He opens shafts in a valley away from where anyone lives. They are forgotten by travelers. They hang in the air far away from mankind. They swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it comes bread. But underneath, it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are the place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. I think God intended us to use the resources he put in this planet. I think he intended us to go down and mine these things out. Technology that we're using, the cars that we drove here, and all sorts of things are made because we're made in God's image, given the dominion, able to create, able to invent, able to discover. But these guys were down there with a pick and a hammer and a shovel, pushing it out, hanging on little cords. Today, in West Virginia, we use dynamite to just blow the entire mountain up, drag line the whole thing, take out whatever coal we can find, throw the rest of it over the side into the valley, and poison all the water. It can't last. And so here's my conclusion. Three slides left. Because here's what I contend, that this is a theocentric environment, that is, God made it for himself. This is Romans 8, verse 18 to 22. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. So God, even in the New Testament, it's not just the Old Testament law, the New Testament, God shows concern for creation. He shows that he is working redemptively to redeem creation, that it is currently subjected to futility, but it will eventually be set free from its bondage and come into the fullness of the glory of the children of God. This is God's plan and intent for his world. We have to put that in tension with 2 Peter chapter 3. And this is where we do a little bit of theology, all right? Because we've got a passage where Paul says in Romans 8 that God is going to redeem creation. And Peter says this in 2 Peter 3:10, but the day of the Lord will come like a thief. And then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done in it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn. But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Between these two passages, this one, subjected to futility, set free from corruption, brought into the glory of God, the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies melt as they burn. Well, here's where the theologian in me goes, is there is this certain and sure knowledge that in the end, God will do as God has intended. That God will ultimately redeem not only mankind, but creation. And that this is descriptive of what the end looks like before the end. This is the penultimate end. I always like it when I get to use the word penultimate. It doesn't come up very often. Penultimate is one before the ultimate. This is the penultimate. You go, this is the climax. You go, no, this is not the climax. This is the moment before the climax when finally, and this, I think, tells us how this whole thing is going to end. But listen, brother and sister, you don't want to be the ones that are complicit in this. You don't want to be complicit in the burning up of this world. Right? I mean, this is how it's going to end. But should it be because I have no concern for the creatures or the system God has put here? I mean, my anthropocentric neighbor may have no concern for those things. My biocentric neighbor may make an idol of those things. But the Christian should be something entirely different, an entirely different animal. Neither left nor right when it comes to environmentalism, but a theologically sound creature. Here's the last slide. And I love this. I love this. Okay. Here it is. End of the Bible. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. This is the final word, the new heavens and the new earth. The thing I love is this is when we see God's presence coming down. And catch this, okay? We always get this thought that, you know, someday when you die, you will get to go to heaven and be with God. No, the Bible says God will come down and be with us. That this world that he made for himself. Somebody find me Colossians 1. I want to read it before I'm done. You got it? Let me borrow. Okay. Colossians 1. Verse 15, this is about Christ. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. For him. When the Bible says that we are co-heirs with Christ, the whole world is created for him. And I am a co-heir with Christ, which means all the right whales are mine. All the buffaloes are mine. All the gold in the world is mine. Why? Because it's God's gold. It's Christ's gold. It was made for him. And he's going to pave the streets with it eventually. We won't need it. Thank you, Phil. This is the thing. This is the marvel of this thing, that God has made this world for himself. Everything in the world belongs rightly to him and to his son. And the final state described everywhere in Scripture is this, that the Bible, which begins in Eden and then falls into sin, will be redeemed from sin and ends in Eden. Read the final chapter of the Bible. The tree of life is there. The river of life is flowing through it. The leaves are for the healing of the nations. God made this world for himself, and he intends to dwell with us here forever. And that should, I think, have something to say when it comes to how I think about the world that I live in. So, we're going to pause. We're going to have coffee, tea. I don't know if there's any refreshments. You can look. And then in a few minutes' time, we'll come back, and you can pepper me with as many questions as you want to. So, okay, I'll invite you back in, and we'll... There we go. So... All right, fair warning. I know that this presentation raises questions that doesn't necessarily offer answers. And I have to say, and I will take any questions you've got, there are certain issues there that I don't know what the answer to that is. Right? And there are some things in this world that I think the best we can have is to say, I got questions and I'm going to go searching. I'm going to go looking. But anyways, at the end of this little book, this was a great little book, she had a little section on things that you can do and to be a better steward. And I won't read those out because she's got about 17 of those. My wife really likes them, even though when I was talking about this at the beginning of the day, my wife was a little bit like, wow. Yeah, we were having a discussion, you know. I think she thought I was getting a little too hippy-dippy with my sandals on. But then when she heard some of these things and she was like, I can turn this into making him dig up the garden for me. Now all of a sudden she came home, she says, I'm thinking about that list. I need you to get a load of manure for the garden. So anyways, comments or questions, anything at all? Monty.
Okay, so how did we explain dinosaurs? Were they killed at the flood?
Yeah, so I would say to you that I think that probably dinosaurs were wiped out at the flood. That would be my take. And, you know, I know that there are old earth creationists, but I'm not one of them. So I can't give you the answer. I can tell you what they would say, but I don't buy it. I think there is evidence there that dinosaurs, we've got fossil evidence that shows dinosaur prints in the same substrate as human prints. That kind of stuff gets suppressed a little bit. And my take on this, because the question will come, well, where did all the fossil fuels come from? I mean, we call them fossil fuels because fossil fuels. One of two answers. And one is in the great deluge, in the great flood, you have the disruption of all sorts of soils and stuff, the breaking forth of the deep. And I think that provides ample opportunity for those dinosaur bones to get buried and the amount of pressure put on them to maybe produce those fossil fuels. The answer that I like even better, it comes from Al Mohler, who's the president down at Southern Seminary, and he says, we believe that when God created Adam and Eve, he did not create Adam as the size of Casey, who is toddling around here, falling over and just about tripping his mom. We believe that God created Adam in the primal life, somewhere probably not too much older than what Sam is, you know, able to run, jump, do, think. He was an adult, right? If we believe that God creates the first man and the first woman fully complete and fully mature, then if God, who creates the world by calling it into existence, can create man in his maturity, why can he not create the earth in full maturity, complete with all of the resources already within it? So that's me as a 7-day creationist, giving you the 7-day creationist answer.
And my second question, and last question, how old do you think the world is?
I think the world is probably not very much older than humanity. I think the world's probably about 5 days older than humanity, Adam and Eve coming in on day 6, right? Which means I have to come up with answers for, you know, the fact that I do think that the world is probably not more than 6,000 or 7,000 years old. But I am a 6-day creationist. And my primary answer to that is Al Mohler's answer. God creates a mature man and a mature woman, and God creates a mature earth. So, anyways, we can probe those steps further if you want, but that's...
Science would tell you that it took millions of years to produce the oil that's in the ground. Back in the 70s, sometimes they were doing that. They created oil and garbage in 20 minutes. Just put enough pressure on it.
Yeah, for sure. There's different things that can do that sort of stuff. That is outside. I'm a theologian. Science is outside of my wheelhouse. Although I do sometimes read on purpose, and I challenge you a little bit on this, to go and read outside, read above your pay grade every once in a while. It's amazing. God created us in His image with the ability to reason. If all you ever do is read novels, and I read novels because I think, you know, the mind wants to. I'm almost done the entire canon of Dickens novels. Basically, I read all 100-year-old novels. But I mean, the mind has an enormous capacity. A couple of years ago, I said, I don't want to just walk around the forest and not know what I'm looking at. I want to be able to identify trees based on their leaves and on their bark. And so I started reading all that kind of stuff. And I'm not quite there yet, but I can, you know, I want to know how to build bicycles from scratch. You've been watching my Facebook. I've been rebuilding. The human mind is an incredible thing. So I do read, what was it? I read some book on quarks and neutrons and protons, and 65% went over my head, but it's good to do that sometimes. But yes, science is, there's all kinds of ways. I know I'm rambling here, but I'll pull this in and say this. When you begin with a presupposition, you then begin to search for the answer to that presupposition. My presupposition is God created the world in 6 days. And so now, how do I answer that? I go searching for how did he do it? You know, because I think that we can learn how those things can be done. You know, if your presupposition is if this was a Big Bang, that system has its own set of issues. Down a rabbit trail, and then I'll come back to questions. My boys have heard this story before, that I used to give my science teachers a really hard time, because I was like this in high school as well. Monty, you're a high school teacher. And I used to bring a coffee can in and put it on my desk in science class. And after like a couple of weeks, the science teacher would say, well, what is that? And I said, it's a science experiment. Well, what's your science experiment? I said, I'm trying to get a Big Bang. I said, I put nothing in the can, and I just keep checking to see whether or not a bang will, you know, and that would usually provoke a little bit of a laugh in the class. And then you get into the question of how does something come from nothing, and how does the something that comes, I mean, I think about this when I go on these bicycle trips, you know, the mechanism of my bicycle, all those spokes, all of those, I talked to one guy who rebuilt a bicycle the first time he ever did it. He said he took it all apart, put it all back together, and at the end of the day, he said, I had about 25 little metal balls, and I thought, where'd these things come from? And he says it never worked right after that, right? You know, because we figured out, you know, you need those bearings in there to keep everything tight. But, you know, we came up with this fairly simple piece of machinery, this bicycle, and this bicycle here has carried me 3,500 kilometers, and this summer hopefully will carry me another 2,000 kilometers, you know, just using chains and little, if I left that sitting there, and there was a, you know, 1,000 years went by, and the whole ocean kind of came in and swallowed that up, and somebody finally came down and was digging around and pulled this out of the ground, you know, in a fossilized state, nobody would look at that and go, oh my goodness, look at this thing that came randomly together. I mean, they would look and go, somebody designed that. There's 120 kilograms of tension on every one of those spokes. There's the right number of teeth on each one of those sprockets. There's cables that change the gears. That's a simple, simple machine. It does not take an awful lot of engineering to figure out how to build a bicycle, but that bicycle will let me go up mountains and down mountains without ever changing the pace that my feet are going around, just using gearing. Nobody would look at that and say, well, that was chance. And yet, the human eyeball, which is way better than the camera on my phone that took this picture, you know, and every single human being on earth has two of those things, and the legs that actually, the only thing on this all wears out, the legs actually get stronger for a certain number of years, you know. They do, they get stronger, they get bigger, you get more powerful, you know, the lungs can develop and ride for, you know, 18 hours for 185 kilometers, you know, and yet we've got people that look at this and say, this is random, this is chance, this is just, you know, coincidence that, okay, you go, this is a highly engineered piece of equipment. You know, it's very hard to get away from design when you start looking. Anyways, we're down a rabbit trail. Sorry, my wife's like, rabbit trail. Gary.
What is that, a calendar in the back of your bike?
That's a big sign that my daughter drew for me that says, have a nice day. And the whole idea behind that, it's got little things that glitter and there's little streamers. Any kind of motion tends to draw the eye, and it's just meant to kind of, and it's got flashing lights on it, all kinds of stuff, and it's just designed to try to keep people from running me over on the highway. And it says have a nice day because if you say something unpleasant like, you know, give me a break, or drivers are jerks, that then they do run you over, you know. You just, it says have a nice day, and I get a lot of people wave at me, have a nice day, you know.
Another question, when you were over in Toronto, did you ride on the side of the road on the QE?
No. Do you know, you can go from Simcoe to Toronto with almost never leaving the rail trail system. There's only a few places you actually have to get onto a public road at all, and once you get into Toronto itself, Toronto has like converted half their streets to have bicycle lanes that are guarded by concrete blocks and have their own set of signal lights. Like Toronto, you never feel more safe than cruising around Toronto on a bicycle. It's a weird experience. So
I disagree.
Well, yeah.
Because I'm going to run a few of them over in a rainstorm, and here are these guys delivering pieces and stuff in the back, and they're wearing, you know, black clothes at night, not no reflective clothing, no nothing. Yeah. And they're dirt in and out.
Well, they weren't following the bike roads. Oh, yeah, obviously. Yeah. If you stay on the bike roads, but
how many of them? Yeah.
So if you're feeling up to it, Monty, give me a call sometime. We'll put our bikes on the trail and off we go. So, all right. Other comments or questions?
So what do you do on Earth Day besides learn on Earth Day?
I've been really, you know, I'm a little convicted. I'm glad for this study because the reality is, I think most people, myself included, You go through the world unexamined, just kind of, you know, going like, this is what I think, this is what I've always thought, I continue to think this way, there's nothing that makes me want to change my mind. Everybody that says anything different, I think they're a bunch of kooky Fruit Loops, and why should I listen to the kooky Fruit Loops? You know, so having had the opportunity to, you know, to dig in, because I said I'm going to teach on this, reading Sandra Richter, reading a number of different articles, looking at a few things, I have to repent a little bit of falling, I think, too heavily into an anthropocentric idea, and now looking and going, you know, I have some concerns, I have some questions. Part of the reason I gave you more questions than answers is because I don't have answers on some of this stuff. But I do look at this and say, I do believe, I don't think it's spin when we read or hear about places where there are countries that are burning up the Amazon in order to get more pasture land to grow beef to sell to North America because we want so much beef. And you know, you go, I don't think that's probably a good idea. And I think the only, you know, you could go down there and legislate and say you can't burn any more of this up, go back to your poverty. I think part of the answer has to be I've got to adjust a little bit of how I live and invite people to say, you know, maybe we look at things a little bit differently. You know, I do think that there are many, many, many people in the world who live in a great deal of poverty, and some of that we might be complicit in. You know, and I think that requires a little bit of pause and a little bit of consideration. And I don't have answers to that. I've got questions, and if it makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable, it makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. So, Jack?
What would you say if you were confronted by a person who said to you that animals deserve exactly the same privileges that you enjoy?
I think I would take him to Genesis 1, where it says God made man in his image, you know, but I think the first thing I would want to do is to diffuse that conversation by saying, you know, that's you raise an interesting point. Do you want to get a cup of fair trade coffee and sit down and have a conversation? Because I think too often we become very combative. I didn't put it into the study today, but I am very concerned in this 21st century with the level of extremism that we are seeing in the world on both sides of the issue. And my argument is I don't think that the Christian should be an extremist. We are... I get myself in so much trouble with these things. What I mean by that is... I absolutely don't want to compromise on gospel. I don't want to compromise on scripture. But I do want to take a couple steps towards my neighbor and say, let's sit down and have a coffee. You know, rather than he hits me in the face and says, you know, you Christians, think that animals are beneath you. And I, you know, so, but yeah, so to come right to the question, because I'm rambling around and I'm a little, my answer to that person would be to take them to Genesis and to say God created man in his own image. What does it mean? And I think the evidence is very evident that there is something distinctly different, intrinsically different about a human being than any other creature on the earth. And that itself argues for human beings having rights that no other animal can have. But having said that, I do think that God, in his scripture, makes it clear that he wants the beasts in the field and the forest to have an enjoyable life, as much as they can have an enjoyable life, that I should not see them as something that I lock up and incarcerate in such a way that I treat them as their only value is in whatever value they give to me, if that makes sense. And I think, with the exception of the extreme extremist, for many people who are kind of living in that zone, that draws them a little closer and opens the door for for a better conversation to be happening with my neighbor than they're way over here and I'm way over here. We're kind of talking and they're coming again. You know, I had a conversation with this Christian guy, and you know, he actually thinks that animals have value. And I think people should come away saying Christians believe animals have value, and the value is not just how delicious they are. And I will say this, there are many animals that are quite delicious. And you may have eaten more varieties than I have, Jack, because I know you've eaten some bears and some moose and stuff like that. But I've eaten a lot of different animals, and quite delicious. So, Monty?
What do you think of people who say that God created us to be vegetarians because Adam was supposed to tend the garden?
Yeah, you know, this is one of those interesting things, because I think in the new heavens and the new earth, I don't foresee the new heavens and the new earth being a place where we will, you know, be slaughtering cows. You know, and I think God in the resurrection body has, if he could engineer this body, I don't think that the science is so difficult for him to engineer the body to run entirely on something other than animal meat. And I also know that he says at his right hand are pleasures forevermore, so I know that there's some way that he can make those mushroom burgers taste better than they do now, you know, because, yeah, I mean, I think there's probably something to the fact that in Eden, in their original state, Adam and Eve did not eat meat. I also don't think that Adam and Eve probably lasted more than 3 weeks before the fall. That's an exaggeration. I don't think they made a week. I'll tell you why. Because God put them in a perfect garden with no sin, no corruption, nothing wrong, said be fruitful and multiply, and when Eve fell, she was not pregnant. That tells me they were not 9 months in that garden. Right? You know? Yeah. So, I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, long-time Bible reading and deep theology leads you to some interesting conclusions. You're like, wow, that makes perfect sense. But, yeah. So, I think in the end, I don't think God intends us today to live as vegans and vegetarians, because all through Scripture, he has animal sacrifice. There are places where the people are invited to feast. Jesus himself, you know, I'm trying to think, do we have a picture of yes, yeah, take and kill and eat, right? But I find myself thinking that in the final state it will not be so, because I can't.
The lamb will lay with the lion, yeah. And the lion will eat straw.
Yeah. Yeah.
He will change.
Good question. Thank you. Gary?
Yeah, I think I can speak on behalf of everybody here that you've done a wonderful job in the study, and it's been mind-opening, and we're fortunate to have a wonderful pastor like you who digs into the history and, you know, and is so involved in what he's talking about. And we're so fortunate here. And, I mean, this study, you know, this is the first major study I've been through with you. And it was mind-blowing, you know. I mean, you know, I couldn't imagine how many hours you must have to spend reading all these books. And then trying to take it all in and do all this. So on behalf of everybody here, I'd like to thank you, and I'm sure they would too.
Thanks, Jerry. Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Going down the rabbit trails.
Yeah, down the rabbit trails. I love the rabbit trails. The rabbit trails are fun. Rick?
I was going to say, I heard the scientists say something couple of weeks ago, it made me think, are birds aware of our existence? You know, that was interesting. You know, like if you look at a raven or anything like that, it's very, very tough. You can see it across the street.
Yeah.
Are they aware of their existence? That's interesting.
Yeah, Yeah, I think I'd have to ask him to define his terms. Like, I don't think that birds or anything in the animal kingdom has some form of philosophy where they're like sitting around in their own language debating the meaning of life. I mean, if that's what it means, are they aware of their existence? You know, are they aware that they're alive? You know, I think so, you know, but I'd have to hear the conversation to understand that. Yeah.
Because we have the ability to think of ourselves, but if they have a brain, it's just a map of survival. They have no idea, they're not thinking.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think they have a deep philosophy of why are my feathers black? That I don't think really occurs. All right. Any others? All right. Well, thank you everybody for coming to the study. Thanks for your questions and. Feel free to kind of communicate to me things you'd be interested in tackling next, and keep your ear to the ground. I'll hopefully, maybe, probably not by this Sunday because I got Micah to pick up tomorrow, but by next Sunday, hopefully I have a short study to announce for anybody who wants to take that in. But certainly, if you've got like something like this, an in-depth study that you'd like to see, I'm going to take the summer to read, and so I'd be happy to work something like that up. So anyways, thank you and good night.